everyone. My name is Courtney. I'm a grateful recovered drug addict.
Courtney.
I'm also a recovery manager on the women's side here at Benchmark. I want to take a second to welcome everybody here. This is really high up. Okay, I'm not going to do that the whole time. First, I want to give a shout out to Cole Hunt. He's got 1 year today. He's one of our alumni, for those of you who haven't met him yet. First, thank you so much, parents, spouses, children, everyone, for coming to support your family. We really appreciate that. So we host this meeting the second Saturday of every month. People in recovery are welcome to attend. Attendance will assist in your departure after the meeting. Please follow the directions and keep in mind that we request that all visitors be off property by 9:30 p.m. You can go to our website, www.benchmarkcenter.com, and get information about events that will be hosted here at the hall. We have a visitor's register located on the same table with the flyers back there by the plant. And if you leave us your name and email address, we will send you notifications of upcoming events. Please remember that the first restroom down the hall is reserved for the ladies in attendance. Gentlemen will use the restroom at the end of the hall. Technical difficulties. So we ask that you please turn off your cell phones, and when we close the meeting, please just stand at your chairs for the Lord's Prayer. We don't want to try and circle up in this hallway. Everyone, please help me welcoming our resident chairperson, Kelsey.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Saturday night open speaker meeting of Benchmark Recovery Center. My name is Kelsey, and I'm an alcoholic. This is not an AA or CA meeting, so the speaker may discuss other topics related to recovery. Please turn off cell phones to the silent setting. Let us open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with what you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I have asked Kirsten to read how it works from Chapter 5 of the Big Book.
All right, Kirsten.
I'm Kirsten, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Kirsten.
How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made a direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C. That God could and would have cured us.
Thank you, Kirsten. Jonathan will introduce the speaker for this evening.
Hey guys, I'm Jonathan. I'm an addict and an alcoholic. I'm very honored to be able to introduce Adrian. I met Adrian last year while we were in Vegas. I think Aaron was there and Joe, my sponsor, was there. And you know, here at Benchmark, I think we lean real heavily on the recovery side of that triangle and getting guys through the steps and trying to really push the importance of that third of the of that recovery triangle. But my meeting Adrian and us continuing kind of on this journey a year later is all about the importance of that one that lots of times we don't talk about much, and that's that unity side. You know, when I got out of here in 08, I didn't think that that was that important. You know, and again, I was kind of indoctrinated into the steps and stuff like that. But when I met Adrian, it wasn't about any step work or anything like that. We were just together at a conference, kind of a men's annual thing, and our hearts connected. And we hung out while we were in Vegas and have kind of stayed connected, you know, through the year on Facebook. And then, you know, kind of, you know, reunited last night when me and Marsh and Adrian were able to go out. So he has a very powerful story. He's got some connections to Don Pritz and Mark Houston. I know you guys are going to be thoroughly entertained and informed with his experience with the work. So, Adrian, come on up.
My name is Adrian Clark, and I'm an alcoholic. I got three waters. I might need another three, actually. I'll see, you know. I'd like to thank Jonathan for introducing me and his hospitality and Marsh's hospitality and everybody else since I've got here to Austin. I want to clear a couple of things up. First, I reside in New York, and I originally come from Ireland, not Iowa or Scotland or all those other places that you people thought I was from. I want to thank Sam for... Where's Sam? I want to thank Sam. He came and hosted me today, and he picked me up, and he brought me over here. And he said, "Man, you don't sound like you're from Iowa at all." And I'm like, "I'm not. I'm from Ireland, you know." And I've lived in New York for, well, the best part of my recovery. And some of my sober family are here today, and that's really important to me today. Joe and Aaron and Jonathan and... And you know, man, when I came to Austin, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and I went into that room and I sit down, and you know, you hear the same whining, the same... You meet your extended sober family, so you do. And that's what I do anywhere I go. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. I'm an alcoholic, and I've been addicted to just about anything that's ever given me a buzz. There's a charge goes off in my ego. It just loves the adrenaline and stuff, and that's been my story from day one. This is a high point in my recovery here. I felt the energy when I came in here today. And that's for lots of different reasons, because there's some really good God stuff going on in here that I've known about for quite a while. The guy that got this up and running was very instrumental in my recovery, and I got to meet him. The guy that got him up and running was even more instrumental in my recovery, a guy called Don Pritz, who is the most loving man I've ever met in my whole life. And he set a fire in Alcoholics Anonymous that's still blazing today. It's unbelievable what that man done. And that was a life-changing moment for me, meeting that guy. And then this other guy, Mark, I met him. He was just another messenger. And you're so lucky to be in a place like this. And the people in this room tonight, we are the lucky ones. I get to see how evil this illness is. I get to see it on a daily basis. And we're lucky in here. You've got an opportunity to heal and fit back into society here. And it really does work. Man, I tell you, I came from Ireland to, and I had a sponsor and I got sober. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story, and I hope most of you can understand me and don't start nodding off and thinking I really get this accent drinking Irish whiskey and I'm not really, you know, I'm not really from Ireland and stuff, because I really am. And I come from a place called Belfast, and for those of you that don't know where that is, it's real simple. If you look at a map of the world, like 4 inches west of New York City, there's a place called Ireland, and Belfast is right at the tip of it. And if you don't know where New York is, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I grew up there in a time frame where, for those of you that don't know, my country has been at war with the British for over 800 years. And Irish people like to do two things, drink and fight, you know? So we kind of welcomed the war with the Brits, you know. And we've been at war with the Brits for over 800 years. And I grew up in a place called West Belfast where it was just crazy from my first memories. I would see these British soldiers running around the streets with their faces painted with guns, and there would be bombs going off. And I got to tell you, what started to happen to me became my biggest secret ever, that I was afraid. And I would see these things going on. And I would stand behind my mother and I'd be afraid. And, that's how it started out for me. And I came to a place with fear growing up and seeing all this stuff. I got kicked into the Christian Brothers school when I was 4 years of age. And I was afraid of that too. And, I loved religious studies. I really did. Because when I look back over my life, I've always been a seeker. But I always wanted to have a relationship with God. I've always wanted to have one. I just never knew how to do it. And if I can say anything to you tonight in here, recovery is about one thing. It's about many things, but the core of it is about having a spiritual awakening. That's the deal here. That's what everything is guided towards, the steps. You know, it talks about having had a spiritual awakening in the 12th step. It doesn't say anything in there about quitting using drugs or drinking alcohol. It talks about having had a spiritual awakening as a byproduct of the first 11 steps. You know, the service, everything, it's all geared towards having this spiritual awakening. And I wanted to have a relationship with God from day one. I really remember that. I remember going to church with my mom. You know, I'm a Irish Catholic alcoholic. And I remember going to church with my mom and going into the church and feeling the energy in there and sitting on my father's lap and seeing the priest giving the service. And I actually wanted to be a priest. I remember going into the back room and getting a little picture of St. Anthony and a little picture of Sacred Heart and getting my grandmother's rosary beads and sitting down and saying the rosary when I was like 9 years of age. My mom would look into the back room and go, "Oh, look at Father Adrian," you know? And I got to tell you, the first two spiritual experiences I had in my life, the first one was when Paula McDermott stuck her tongue down my throat. I knew at that moment the priesthood was not for me. You know, and I got to tell you, if I look back over my childhood, I've suffered from nothing but self-centered fear my whole life. And the two key moments of that self-centered fear was the first one, when I knew that I had to go kiss her. I remember the fear welling up in my stomach and thinking, "Oh my God, this is going to finish me if I lose it up. If I do this wrong, I'm in trouble here." And I got to tell you guys, I became pretty good at it. You know, and the exact opposite happened. It was wonderful. I loved it. And another story. And the second time was, I remember the self-centered fear the first time I got loaded and thinking, you know what, I'm going to mess this up. This is going to go wrong. My reputation's on the line again. You see, I need to uphold the reputation. I don't want anybody to ever know that I'm afraid. You know? And I remember the first time I had that drink of alcohol. That really, and it wasn't the first time I drank alcohol, because I dabbled in it. I dabbled in it from when I was a kid. I'd go to the fridge, I'd try a beer, I'd try my grandmother's gin, and, you know, I'd mess around with it. But that first time I had that alcohol, the first time it hit that spot, and I got that get up, want to go to town party feeling, woof, the lights come on. And I didn't know till I got here in the Alcoholics Anonymous that normal people that drink alcohol socially don't have that experience with it. They really don't. And my alcoholism kicked off from the start. And if there's a condition, if there's a precondition, the act of alcoholism, which a lot of us talk about, you know, we say different things in here, like, oh, I was an alcoholic from when I was born. I don't know if I was an alcoholic. If there's a condition that comes before active alcoholism, I had it. I had it. You know? I remember the uncomfortability going into that Christian Brothers school, being afraid of those Christian Brothers that would have their weapons, hit up their cloak, and getting beat around the place and stuff. And my relationship with that God that I had started to change, and it started to falter, and the people that represented God to me were people that I was afraid of. You know, and my prejudices started there. And I didn't learn this stuff till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous through doing good, deep, thorough step work. You know, and I started drinking alcoholically pretty much from the beginning, and it was a lot of fun. And by the time I was 18 years of age, I'd probably lost 5 jobs. You know, I was the sort of guy that would go out drinking all night. I'd stand in the park drinking bottles of wine, bottles of cider. With my buddies, everyone done it. You know, Irish people like to drink. They still do. And it was okay. It really was. And I would stand in the park all night and drink bottles of wine and bottles of cider. And I'd go to work the next morning. And I would die with hangovers all day. And I would say to myself, I'm never going to drink again. The war had started right there and then with me. I'm never going to drink again. I'm never going to do it again. And by noon, I'd be doing it again. And I'd go and I'd stand in the park all night again and I'd get drunk. And this would happen for days and days till I would just conk out and fall down. And that's where my drinking began. That's where my drinking began. A couple of years after that, my father was already bringing me to outpatient. So I was coming home so messed up and so bombed out of it. I didn't know if I was coming or going. I was wrecking the house. I was trying to get into bed beside my mother and father. I didn't know what was going on. I was peeing in places where I shouldn't have been peeing. And my father was putting me in bed. I'm breaking windows. And I'm waking up the next morning and I can't remember any of it. You know? That's where my drinking began. And you see, the reason why you're so lucky to be in a place like this, when I grew up in the north of Ireland, back in those times, I never heard of a detox. Never heard of a rehab. A rehab was for some American in some movie. We didn't have them in Ireland because we really don't have a problem with alcoholism over there. You know? even if there was detoxes or rehabs, I wouldn't have known to go to them because I didn't know what my problem was. And my father would bring me to these doctors. You know, I want to welcome the families here tonight. I got to tell you, because I can't help but think what I'd done to my family and what you go through. I don't know. I know it's not nice. And I think it would be obnoxious of me to say, you know, I understand what you go through, but I do understand one thing, the power of amends and stuff. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, about what I've done to my family and stuff, and how I put that right with them. And, you know, I would go to these doctors, and doctors started to do to me from an early stage what everybody tried to do to me. From outward appearances, I look like, you know, a complete utter lunatic when I drink and when I don't drink. Because really, as an alcoholic and a drug addict, I got two problems. I got a problem when I drink. Can't control the amount that I take. I got an even bigger problem when I don't drink. Because I can't bear me. And my mom's been telling me from day one, there's something wrong with your head. And I'm like, I know, but I don't know what it is. It won't stop. It won't leave me alone. It's ripping me up. It's ripping me to pieces. And our book talks about my main problem is an alcoholic centers in my mind. That's right. I think a lot of us just stop there and leave it there. But if you keep reading the book on, it tells me that's not where it starts. It centers in my mind, but that's not where it comes from. I got a soul sickness. I got a sickness that comes from the depths of my soul that when I don't drink, there's something happens inside of me and it's horrible. And it ebbs and it gnaws its way through my system. And it comes through my system in such an uncomfortable way. I get these overbearing feelings that I need to get my own way or this is not going to go good. And the problem is, even when I do get my own way, it's still the same. I'm still not satisfied. And it ebbs its way through my system. And something goes off in my mind that tells me, you know what it'll fix is. And I've been a relief-seeking junkie my whole life. You know, I've been a scared of this present moment my whole life. And when I took that alcohol, it took it away. And I started upon a journey of doctors, psychiatrists, all kinds of people to find out what was wrong with me, and every time they would aim for my mind. You know, let's shrink him down, let's quack him, let's talk to him. They'd put me towards therapy, they'd put me towards medication, and the end result would happen every time. You see, my software is set for me always to go back to Adrian, to go on a path of self-sabotage and pick something up to kill the pain. And there's nothing will cut into that. And the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is, this book, called Alcoholics Anonymous, this doesn't go for my mind. It shoots right into my soul. And no one ever knew to shoot into my soul, because no one ever knew that I had a soul sickness. Not even I. Not even I. And I started to rob, lie, cheat, steal, do geographical changes to the other side of the world. I get drunk, run away to London. Now, that's the kind of decisions I make. We're at war with the British for over 800 years, and I think, oh, London will be a great place to move to, you know? And needless to say, that didn't work out well. Around the time that I went to London, just before I went, that's when I really started getting into trouble with drugs and selling them. I come from good people. I come from good stock. I know what a good, happy home looks like. I used to run away from home all the time. Children would have broke into my home to live in it. It was such a happy home, you know? And I would run away to London, and I'd get drunk, and I'd get all messed up in drugs, and I'd come back, and my father'd sit down, and he'd try to patronize me, and he'd give me the drug talk, and he'd give me everything. And what I started to do over a period of time, my father was a hard-working Irishman. He was a very tough guy. He was very respected in the community. He was a family man. And he worked really hard for his money, and over a period of a few years, I started to do one of the things that I'm most shameful for. I've done many things out there that still pull on my heartstrings right until this day. I started to steal from him his life savings over a period of time. And I'm not talking about $100 or $200 or $1,000. I'm talking about all of it over a period of time. And I couldn't stop doing it. And every time I done it, to go to get drunk, to go to get high, I knew what I was doing. And it came to a point in time where I couldn't take it anymore, and I continued to do it. And I got away with it for years and years and years. And on top of that, I stole from my grandmother, my mother, my sisters, and just about everybody else that I knew. I would do burglaries around where I lived in Ireland, all the whole way along the street. And the first place that I would look when I broke into their house was the refrigerator. Because I wasn't interested in TVs or watches or jewelry or money. I mean, I was, but I was interested in alcohol. Because it done for me something that was truly magical. And the trouble, that's how it rolled on. And I left school. I was a pretty good athlete. I left school and got a scholarship to be a professional soccer player. So I did. And 3 months into that course, my college tutors called me in and said, Adrian, this is not working out. We need you here every day. Because I couldn't show up. Because I'd get struck with these depressions when we would go away to play and we'd go away to train, and that soul sickness would always be rapping on my door. And I would lie in my room with the bed sheets over my head full of fear, with a body full of sick emotions that would rattle through me that I didn't understand, that I didn't know. There'd be so much fear, there'd be so much resentment, and I just didn't understand it. All I knew, that alcohol and drugs was what took it away. And I was on a search. I tried everything. I became a violent drunk, a very violent drunk. I started to do things that I'd wake up the next morning and I wouldn't know what it would be. My head would be stuck to the pillow with hard blood. Some mornings I'd wake up, my eyes would be closed, and I became very, very violent. And I got to tell you, the two things that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, the two main things that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous were violence and fear. Those two things. Crazy things started to happen. And when I was 20 years of age, my alcoholism, I'd already tried to escape a couple of times through suicide. And in 1994, the reason how I can remember was because the World Cup was on and I was a big soccer fan. And I went to a soccer game that day to watch Ireland play. And something happened that night that I'll never forget. And it was a turning point in my drinking. I was coming. I'd started drinking at noon that day, and I was coming home from the game. And when I say I started drinking at noon that day, I was doing a pile of other stuff too. You know? I mean, when an Irishman mixes cider, vodka, and crystal meth, I gotta tell you, I was the first Irish man on the moon. You know? But don't any of you guys in here be thinking you need to go try that? You don't. You know? And I remember coming home that night, and I remember coming out of a blackout, and I was swinging concrete posts at a whole platoon of British soldiers who are fully armed in rat gear with SLR rifles. They got armored trucks, everything, and they think they've won the lottery. They're not seeing the funny side of it. They're really not. And what they done to me that night, they dragged me through the streets of Belfast, and they gave me such a beat, they kicked my teeth into the back of my head. And I've done a little research on blackouts. You actually know what you're doing in a blackout. You don't have the memory lapse until you come out of the blackout. And believe me, I've come out of this blackout, and it's not good. And I'm dragged away, and I'm brought to a prison cell. There was a constable there. Now, the reason why I tell you this story is I've got off in this story for years and years and years, but the real reason why I want to tell you it is it's not to be the bravado drunk love, because that's not really what was going on. What was really going on was Adrian was afraid again, and he wants to fit in, and he wants people to leave him alone. And let me tell you, if you want to fit in a place like Belfast and be left alone, that's the thing to do right there. You know? And I remember getting locked in that prison cell and being scared for my life. When I woke up the next day, I went into that prison cell like Rambo, and I woke up the next morning like Lambo. And I'm sitting there and I'm covered in blood and I'm wondering what's going on here. And there was a police sergeant that night who was in the army barracks right down the street from where my mother lived, and it was the most bombed out barracks in Western Europe. And him and I became on a first name basis. He was the man that would track me down. He was the man that would have bench warrants out for my arrest. He was the man that sat in the court beside me when I'd done it again. He would drive down the road in an armored car. He would stop. He would open the door when he would see me and he'd say, "Mr. Clark, are you behaving yourself tonight?" And he would come after me every time. And I remember sitting in that cell. And I remember waking up the next morning in that cell and getting down on my knees and saying, "God, if you get me out of this one, I swear I'll never mix cider and vodka again." And I never did. I started drinking Guinness after that. And I went through the courts that time. My violence through alcohol had me detained in two separate British Army barracks. So it had, over a period of time. And guys, I don't want to get into it all because I want to get into recovery here and talk about that. But I could give you a long list of the stuff that I went through. I could give you a long list of, you know, the court, the appearance in court, the being shot, being stabbed, you know, the emergency room in the Royal Victoria Hospital was a place where I ended up on most weekends. I've been in intensive care units, had my head stapled back together. I was a violent drunk, and that's how I drank. I broke my family's heart. I don't know how many beds that I lie in where my mother and father and stuff would lie around me. The type of drinker that I was, I would start drinking on Wednesday or Thursday, and off I'd go on one of those runs, and I would just go and like a savage and rip all around me. And sometimes the following Monday, sometimes the following Tuesday, I'd still be gone. And I was a daily drinker from early on, but I was delusional about my daily drinking. You know, if it was an event, that wasn't classed as drinking. You're supposed to do that. I was a morning drinker. And when I mixed the drugs together, I hit a bottom, guys, that it was unbelievable. I came off the back of one of those really bad runs because the alcohol had really stopped working. And in between this, I'd lived in the United States. I'd lived over here and I'd hit a real bad bottom. I walked around the streets of New York and the wind was blowing through me. That spiritual sickness was blowing through me like a hole in the Grand Canyon, because I was running out of things to fix it with. And I've been trying to fix this hole inside of me for a long, long time. No one has ever been able to tell me up until this point what is wrong with me. I thought it was a schizophrenic. I thought it's some kind of mental illness. I try to think my way around this. No one has ever been able to tell me. Go to that little place inside of me that's been protected, that feels dirty, and say, "Adrian, this is what's wrong with you." And I run around and things just got uglier. You know, my sister came home at Christmas one year and she seen me in such a bad way. She started to do some research to see if they could find a treatment center or something to put me in. And she found a place in Ireland called the Victoria Square Treatment Center. It was an old-time treatment center. And she told me that I had to go the next morning. And I'd done what any good drug addict or alcoholic will do. I told her that I'll go, but I didn't go. And I'd done what I always do. I came back and I lied to her and told her that I'm not a drug addict, I'm an alcoholic, and that I'm allowed to drink and smoke pot. You know, that's familiar with some of you guys, right? You know, and this is what I'd start to do. My father would bring me to doctors and spend good money. And what I would always do is I'd put the drugs on the table, but I'd always protect the alcohol. You know, I would tell the doctor, "Well, you know, I take this drugs," and he'd say, "Okay, you're a drug addict." And I would agree with that. And I would go drinking again, because that was really my first and last love. And then I eventually end up back on the drugs again. But what happened when I come off the back of one of these really bad runs, I got so depressed and I couldn't take it. Even when I was drunk and high, I couldn't get there anymore. One night I came home, and I went into my grandmother's house in Belfast, and I went into her pill cabinet. and I found the biggest bottle of pills that I could find. I had been suicidal for a couple of weeks, and I was planning a way to do it. And I don't know if any of you guys can relate to this, but when you're in that place where you're suicidal, one minute you want to do it, the next minute you don't have the courage, and there's a battle goes on inside your head. And I couldn't build up the courage to do it, and this night I did, and I sat there sobbing. I'd been drinking for days, and I sat there sobbing with a bottle of vodka, and I looked into it, and I thought to myself, I got to do this. I cannot go on like this. I can't live with what my mind is doing to me. The alcohol and the drugs are not even taking it away anymore. And what's going on when I'm not drinking and drugging? I can't get any more than 3-4 days away from alcohol or drugs. I just can't do it. Because what happens to me is that sickness wakens up inside of me and that uncomfortability becomes too much. And what's going on inside of my mind? And I got to tell you, that place that I came through suicide, it wasn't alcohol or drugs that brought me there. That sped up the process. If you think alcohol and drugs is what's brought you into this treatment center, I would disagree with you. It sped up the process. Alcohol and drugs have never been my problem. My problem is always a self-imposed crisis that I create myself every time to be treated with alcohol and drugs. This self that goes on in between my ears, that's what done the damage. That's what brought me to a place of suicide. And I swallowed all those pills and I lay down to die. I just lay down to die. My grandmother, who was 87 years of age at the time, came into my bedroom a couple of hours later, and I'd been lying there pretty much most of the night, and she seen that I was blue, and she seen my lips were blue and that I was white, and she run and got my sister and my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law is a tough Irish guy who's 6'4", and he came down, and he's punching me, and he's pulling me, and they're losing me. I'm drifting out of it. And they got the paramedics there and they got me to the Royal Victoria Hospital. And I remember waking up a couple of days later in the Royal Victoria Hospital with shrinks shining flashlights in my eyes, and I feel someone holding my hand, and it's my father, and he's crying. And I remember lying in that bed with my family around the bed wondering what's going on. And I'm wondering what's going on. I'm bewildered. I don't know what's going on. I can't even kill myself, right? I want out. There's nowhere to go and I can't even do it. And I remember lying in that bed and my best friend coming to visit me. And he said, when you get out of here, I want you to come visit someone with me. And this guy was a Catholic priest who was also a psychologist. And I told him yes just to get him off my back. And I went to visit that Catholic priest. And I sat down with him. And the first question he asked me was, how much do you drink? And I thought, wow, that's a pretty gutsy question to ask someone the first time you meet him. You know? And I lied to him right away. And he said, dude, you're an alcoholic. Now, that wasn't the first time I'd heard that. I'd heard that from just about every one of my family members. My girlfriend, who never wanted to see me again, who dropped me off at my mom's house and told me, I never want to see you again. And I never have seen her again. I've never been able to make a direct amends to her. I tortured her. I ruined her life. Now, this treatment center that I told you that I was going to go to, where my sister sent me to, that I never went to, my best friend that I used to party, and he was a pretty heavy hitter, hit a bottom worse than me, and he came to me looking for help. And through my egotism and my grandiosity, I directed him to this hospital, and it probably saved my life. It probably saved my life. He went into that hospital. It was a 6-week program, and they introduced to him a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he got out of there, he came to visit me with this book, and he started to tell me this story about this doctor from Akron and this stockbroker. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty cool story. And he goes, do you want to hear some more of it? I said, yeah. Can I get a 6-pack? He goes, absolutely. And I got a 6-pack. And he started to 12-step me whilst I was drinking a 6-pack. Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. And I told this priest about this guy who had invited me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me, I want you to go get that guy. And I went. And I got the guy. And the three of us sat down. And the priest said, I want you to bring this guy to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I come in and I sat at the back. I started sitting at the front because he told me to sit there. And night by night, I moved a row back, a row back, a row back. Now, I don't know. There's a lot of good-looking young people in here tonight. And if you come to my home group in New York City on a Tuesday night, there's 700 people meeting there. And tell all these new guys there's some hotties in there. Let me tell you. You know. But not for you just yet. You know. And that's not what AA was like in Belfast. I mean, Peggy was sitting and her teeth were missing and she's talking about how she's finding God. And I'm thinking, Jesus, just find your teeth and put them back in. And the old timers are coming up to me and they're saying things like, you know, what, you know, what, First of all, I can't get my head around the fact there's a room full of people in Ireland that aren't drinking. You know? And that's the main reason why I went. And the old timers are coming up to me and they're saying, son, I've been seeing you coming here every night. What have you been doing? I'm like, well, I joined the gym. And they'd say, son, you're going to be the fittest man in the nut house. And they were right. I ended up being the fittest guy in the nut house. And they would ask me questions, and I became that I know guy, like my sponsor says, the I know guy. I know. Did you get a big book yet? No, I'll get one Thursday. Let me buy you one. No, it's okay. And what happened to me always happens. I go back to pick that drink up. Because here's where my mind works as an alcoholic and an addict. Someone puts a bottle of vodka down in front of me and says, okay, go ahead, drink it, Adrian, it's on the house. I'm like, okay, and I lift it, and I go to drink it, and he pulls a gun out of his waist, and he says, you drink it, I'm going to blow your brains out. I'm that stupid. But here's what happens. I got a man that starts to think things like, maybe if I get him in a headlock and get the gun out of his hand. I start to think, how can I get that gun out of his hand? How can I get that vodka off him? That's never happened to me, but it's happened to me thousands and thousands of times. Every time. Now, guys, if you identify with that, that's called beyond human aid right there. And that happened to me time after time after time. It didn't matter if my mother was sick, my girlfriend was very sick in the hospital. It didn't matter if I had to make another job, lose another job, anything I had to do, guys. It played the trick on me. And I couldn't stop doing it. The craziest thing, the most insane thing that ever happens to me, every time it happens to me when I'm stone cold sober. And that's pick up the first drink. Stone cold sober. I'm never drunk or high when I pick that first drink up. And that's unbelievable. And it happened to me again and again and again. And I started slipping and sliding into the Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hit a bottom, guys, that I thought that I couldn't hit after I tried to take my own life. And for years more, I continued to struggle in and out. I'd go to meetings drunk. I'd call my friend up crying, sobbing because the loneliness and everything that set in was unbelievable. And I couldn't take it anymore. And you're drinking and you're drugging is ruined. Once you come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because all I could think about was AA and the people and the numbers that they'd give me. And I came to your place, guys, off another violent drunk, another violent weekend where I come out of another blackout. I come out of many different blackouts in many different places. And this time I come out of a blackout and I got a guy over a car and his face has just opened up and I'm trying to kill him. And his girlfriend's screaming, and she's ripping my face off me, and I don't know what's going on because I've blacked out again. And I remember waking up that next morning, and that place where I lay down to die and try to take my own life, I get down on my knees and I said, God, I know you're there, and I need your help. And I had the first of what I like to call a series of spiritual experiences. The next day, there was none of this going down and telling my family and stuff, I'm going back to AA, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I suited up and had done it. And I walked back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And right at the end of my drink, and I was living in a room that was 4 foot wide by 8 foot, with a weapon at the side of my bed, with an imaginary friend with an escape route planted through the roof. That's where my mind was at. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went back with, I got to tell you something, any of you new guys, if you want to stick around here and get sober, you need a miracle. And if you want a miracle, You got to create an environment where a miracle can take place. So you do, because it's not going to happen sitting locked in your closet. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and rolled my sleeves up with an eagerness and a desire to do this thing, because I knew it worked. I'd seen it working in my friends. And I walked back into Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, I need help. And I sat down. And they brought me over a big book and they put their names and their numbers on it. And a 19-year-old kid who looked like a choir boy saved my life. He was afraid to come over to me, because I would have been afraid to come over to me. Or I was sitting where my eyes blackened and my face ripped off me. And he said, you know, man, I'm really afraid to come over to you, but my sponsor told me I had to. And I thought, his sponsor's a card? What? The sponsor couldn't have came. He sent a kid, you know. And he came over to me and he said, dude, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm not. He said, would you like to come to a meeting with me tomorrow night in Dunmurry? And I said, I don't have a car. He said, I'll pick you up. And he brought me to my sponsor. That's where I met Kevin. And I got to tell you, when I stopped drinking and drugging and I came in the Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not doing well. My problem has never been drugs or alcohol. And this man knew I wasn't doing well and he proceeded to 12-step me. And I turned around and I asked him the worst question you can ask to anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who's recovered from this illness. Can you tell me what my problem is? He goes, oh, would you like me to do that? Let's sit down and get a coffee. And he said, do you really want to know what your problem is? I said, yeah. He says, when's the last time you had a drink? I said, well, it's been a few days. And he says, well, drinking's not your problem. And I thought right there and then, this moment, oh my God, they're going to throw me out of here as well. And he said, your problem, dude, is you're a selfish, self-centered prick. And I'm like, oh, really? No. And I wanted to slap him right in the face because that's where I dealt with things, because aggression was my middle name. I didn't know how to deal with anything except through aggression and with my fist, and I didn't because I was afraid to. And he cracked my ego right down the middle, gave me the nutcracker, and I started sobbing in front of him. And he started to 12-step me, and he says, I got some questions for you, sunshine. He says, when you put alcohol in your body, he said, do you find it hard to stop? I said, every time. He goes, physical allergy to alcohol. I said, is that what that is? And he started putting tags on things. He says, do you ever plan to not drink and you end up drunk? I said, every day. He goes, mental obsession. And he'd give me the winning combination, the trifecta, the soul sickness, the spiritual part of it. See, alcohol comes in a bottle, guys. Alcoholism comes in people. I've treated my alcoholism with what was in that bottle for years and years and years, and I connected those dots right there and then and conceded to my, wow, I'm an alcoholic, and it scared the life out of me. And I asked him for help, and he told me to go home and read the first part of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and to call him if I wanted to go through with this work. And I went home and done just that. I read the first 63 pages. I called him up, and he came and picked me up the next morning, and I was impressed with that, I got to tell you, because no one wanted me. I was on my own. I had a couple of people that really cared about me, that were really worried about me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was it. And he came and he picked me up, and we talked a little more about the first two steps. And guys, we done something that day that changed my life forever. We got down on our knees and we took the third step prayer together. And I got to tell you, my life took off from that day on. There was no electric feeling or anything, but if I was to place what happened in that room that day, I think I'd taken the first three steps before I came to AA. I just went back over with him again and he started to show me how to write inventory. And my life took off, guys. I had myself resigned with my little man that I was going to be living in some basement apartment in Belfast, working in some labouring job for the rest of my life, guys. And within a year of starting to do that work and starting to make amends and starting to put things right, I was living back in New York City again. I was living back there, and I was wondering why I had to come back here again. Within 2 years, I'd started up a group in New York City. And that's when I started to come in contact with guys like Mark Houston. That whole first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, guys, in Belfast, that group sponsored me. I get into service right away. And I was wondering, why do we do service for? You know, why do we do this stuff for? And the answer is to get me away from me. It's to get me away from me. All the things in this program are designed to get me away from me. My biggest problem is I can't stop thinking about myself. I can't stop doing it. There's never been a 24-hour period where I've been able to stop doing that. And my life took off, guys, and I started working those steps. So I did. I landed a really good job when I came to New York, and I started listening to tapes of Mark Houston. And I started to, God damn it, I got a lot more amends to make. he had me flying all around the world, making amends, and I'd never even met him. You know? He had me flying back to Ireland, and those burglaries and stuff that I'd done, guys, I didn't think you had to make those amends. You know, if they don't know, it can't harm them, right? You know, I mean, you don't want to injure them or others. And I didn't really think you had to do those. And what had happened to me, my first sponsor got me up and running, and he set me on fire. And he showed me the significance, the importance of our primary purpose, of why I got to go into nut houses, why I got to go into detoxes, why I got to come to places like this and carry this message. But I left a lot of step work uncovered. And I got to tell you, I started to feel that spiritual sickness again, that spiritual malady. And I was one of these guys that started to complain and moan about the meetings in New York. Oh, they're terrible. No one carries a message here. I wish I was back in my home group again. And I got to tell you, that's not the case. Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful place. You will find what you're looking for in any 12-step fellowship. There are people that are recovered all over this world. And I just couldn't see it. Because in a way, I wanted to stay sick. You know? I got to tell you, there's many different things that bring us here to this point. One of the things that brought me into recovery was this. Walking out of my father's house one morning and watching him look me square in the eyes, crying and telling me, I can't believe what you've done to me and this family. I want to die. And I could see in my father's eyes that day that he wanted to take his own life. And I went back to make amends to my father in a half-measured way that made matters worse. And it wasn't until I started to get re-sponsored again in Alcoholics Anonymous in New York, where my sponsor sent me back over to Ireland with all the money that I owed him to sit down beside him on the chair beside him and my mother. And I got to tell you, it just didn't start getting put right there and then, because he still didn't really respect me. He was like, well, Adrian's sober and he can sleep in his bed at night. You know, that's the way he looked at it. But I kept persisting with it. And I'd call him 3 times a week from New York to see how he was doing. And I'd go back to Ireland and I'd sit and I'd talk to him. And as we went along doing that, our relationship got better. And every time I went back to Ireland, I would start to make more amends. I've been able to go back to people 25 years later that I burgled their house, that I burgled their car, that I didn't even know where they lived anymore. And I would go back to these people and I'd sit and I'd pray. And I'd say, okay, God, if today's the day that I got to see them, bring me to them. And I remember praying one day that there was this woman that I wanted to go see. And I didn't know where she lived. And she lived in a row of houses in Ireland. There was probably 150 houses in it. And they all looked the same. And I walked around there. And a door opened up. And there was an old man standing there. And he nodded his head at me. And I thought, well, that definitely can't be it. Because that's what I always think when I'm going to make amends. That definitely can't be it. And 25 years later, a car came driving down the street. And it was the actual car that I burgled with the lady driving it. And she drove into that house. And I called my sponsor and he says, well, you better do something. And I went in and I rapped the door. And she said, welcome, Adrian. And she knew my name. And I said, I'm here to make amends. And she said, I know. And I was like, okay. And I went in and I sat down and I explained to her what I'd done 25 years previous. And she said, I know it was you. She said, Adrian, I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous from 1978. And I sat there and I spoke there and I really knew that God had my back. That was unbelievable. My father's a tough old Irish guy, so he is. He doesn't show much emotions. Not like Italian guys. I sponsor a lot of Italian guys. I mean, it's like a different fifth step from an Italian guy and an Irish guy. It's like, you know, they want to sit at the table and cry over mommy and cry over the meatballs and the sauce. And, you know, these Irish guys are more, rah. And it's a whole act, too. And one of those days, I went home to visit my father. And I was coming back to New York. And he drove me back to the airport. As he always did. And as we're driving back to the airport, it's just both of us in the car. And I noticed that he started to well up and he started to cry. And when we get out of the car, he went around to the back of the car and he took my bag out and he sat up beside me and he grabbed me by the head and he kissed me right in the lips and he says, I'm really proud of you, son. I love you. And he called me a short time after that because my cousin was really sick from alcohol and he asked me would there be anything that I could do. Now I know my cousin, believe me, there's nothing I can do. You know? And I told him, Dad, if there was something I could do, I'd be on the first plane home tomorrow. And he said, you know, I'm 74 years of age, son, and I've seen a lot of things in my life. He says, but I ain't never seen anything like you. I've seen the transformation in you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's one of the nicest things that anybody could ever say to me, because all I ever wanted was my father's respect. And I'm a member of the Atlantic Group today in New York, and I got to tell you, man, I've got to sponsor some guys in this fellowship that has been unbelievable. That's what I do today. That's my primary purpose. And I get to go to treatment centers on a weekly basis. Treatment centers like this and low bottom ones. My first sponsor taught me that. My current sponsor is big on that as well. And I go to Bellevue Psych Ward some Wednesday nights. I go to Flushing Detox and I go to these Skid Row places where you see guys sitting there in the paper slippers and the paper pajamas who have nowhere else left to go in society. And I bring my guys in there that I sponsor. I bring them in there. And we all go in. And I'll bring as many guys as they'll let me bring in. And we'll sit down and we'll all tell our story for 10 minutes. What happened, what it's like, and what it's like now. And we'll let them know Alcoholics Anonymous is here and we're here to help. And the greatest thing that has ever happened to me in my recovery, the greatest thing, is to lift one of those guys out of that place and to come and watch him sit down on my sofa and go through what it says in that book for me and watch the lights come back on in his eyes and 6 months later bring his kids over to your home group to introduce them to you because he's got them back in his life. There ain't nothing ever better that's happened to me than just that. And these new guys that I bring in here, I bring guys into these places that are 30 days sober, 40 days sober, and they're already doing fourth, fifth steps, making amends, and something magic happens when we go in there, and I'll tell you what it is. Anytime I go in there and those newcomers are in there and we're walking back out of that place again, they're not smiling. They're laughing and joking with each other because they've been set free in there. There's nothing will set me free like working with another alcoholic. Ever. Nothing. That's the thing that keeps me sober, and that's the thing that's put me up here tonight, is working with others. And I've got guys that come back to me after 5 years and say, I'd like you to meet my wife. Introduce you to my wife. You know, those are the things that have happened to me in here. I've got a relationship with God today that's unbelievable. I really do. That third step experience that I had on my knees with my sponsor, you don't see the impact of the third step till you go through the rest of the work and your life starts to unravel and open. I've taken many third steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, but they've all came from that first one that I've taken. I hope you guys have took the third step in here and meant it. One of the most significant byproducts of that first step, or that third step, is that that obsession to drink has never returned. It's like a spiritual antibiotic, that three-sided triangle. You get a sponsor, you work the steps, you do a fourth step, you do a fifth step, you make these amends, you pray, you meditate, you help others, you do all that over here and the obsession disappears over there. Stop doing it and see what happens. Those treatment centers that I go into, I just met a guy a couple of weeks ago who had 30 years and thought it was a good idea to drink. 30 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I meet people in these treatment centers all the time that had double-digit sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous that drank again, that put needles in their arm again. And then there's a series of questions that I ask them and check them off every time. Did you finish your amends? Well, no. Did you have a sponsor? Well, yeah. Well, when's the last time you called them? You know, I got an illness that has a survival mechanism. It never forgets. It never forgets. At 10 years sober, I sat in a federal courtroom in New York City. So I did, to become an American citizen, because my daughter wanted me to become one, because she was born in this country. The greatest gift that I've had in my sobriety is my 11-year-old daughter. And that judge came out into that court that day, and I thought, big deal, we'll get this over with, and we'll move on. And there was 500 different people from all corners of the earth in that place that day. And he came out, and he gave a speech that totally blew me away. He said, I'm sure there's some stories in this room. And I started to think about landing that mental hospital in Belfast and those other places that I was in. And I started to see what God has done in my life. I live in the greatest country in the world. I got the greatest teachers on the planet. One of them started this around me that have helped me along this way. I'm part of the greatest fellowship in the world. And I've recovered from the greatest illness known to man. And I got to tell you, it's all because of trust in God. That's what these steps mean. Trust in God. Get connected to that spirit and trust in God. And the deal is, only God would be clever enough to hide himself inside you. What a trickster. What a trickster. I mean, he sure fooled me for 26 years. I couldn't find him anywhere. I'm looking for him over here, and I'm looking for him over there. And all the time he's shouting, Adrian, I'm over here, you know. And the book tells me you'll find him deep down within you. But here's the trick. In order for me to get access to that power, I got to help you get access to your power. And it's when I help you get access to your power, then I get access to my power. And what a wonderful thing. And when I get access to that power, that's been my problem all along. Why did I try to kick my own life? Because I had no power. I had no access to power. Didn't know how to do it. What does access to power look like today? Well, when I'm waking up in the morning, guys, I got a different meaning of what success means. I'm looking forward to that morning meditation. I'm looking forward to that prayer. I'm looking forward to them guys calling me that sponsor. That's success today. That's power. I've been able to hold the same job for over 10 years. I haven't wanted to take my own life in a long time. And I haven't wanted to use drugs or alcohol. I just want to live my life and enjoy it today. And it's available to you. And what a foundation you're getting in this place. I wish you all the best. I love you. Thank you very much.